Good morning. Nice to see you all here. I wondered how many would turn up this morning with all the weather and everything, but here we are. We've managed to make it. So let's get this going. Right, so we are doing James chapter 5. We've done the first four chapters. We started this back in May last year, so it's taken us about 9 months to do five chapters. So it's a good job we didn't pick Psalms or Isaiah or something like that, but we get there eventually. So we've looked at chapter 1, the trials of faith. Chapter 2, the works of faith. Chapter 3, words of faith. 4 was the walk of faith, which we did last time, just before Christmas. Or was it after Christmas? I can't remember when we did it. And then today we're looking at waiting faith. We're looking at patience again. Remember, James talked about patience earlier on as well. So that's where we're going. The chapter splits into 5 sections, so we'll look at each of those sections. So this was the first one, warning to the rich and the selfish. Unfortunately, chapter 5 jumps in at the 6-foot end, so it gets easier as we go along. Or is it the way around? I'm not sure, but we'll get there. So verse 1, chapter 5. Now listen, you rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that is coming on you. Your wealth has rotted, and the moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded your wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. And cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the innocent one who was not opposing you. So here James in chapter 5 looks at, has really strong words against the rich and the selfish. I think he must have had first-hand knowledge of this. Something must have affected him and his church. But then when we think of ourselves, it doesn't really apply to us because none of us are rich. And I wondered if we looked, how many of you are rich? Put your hand up if you're rich. Ah, you see, you're thinking the way I'm thinking. I was hoping nobody would put their hand up, you see. All right, put your other hand up if you've got running cold water in your house. Ah, yes. Put your other hand up if you've got hot water in your house. Yes. Hands up if you've got a toilet. Yay, we've all got toilets. Hands up if you've got more than 2 pairs of shoes. Whoa, eh? Hands up if you've got access to a dentist, a doctor, and an optician. Eh? You are rich. This is going to be awkward, isn't it? Anyway, 47% of the world, 47% of the world's population, that's about 4.2 billion people, lack access to safe, drinkable tap water. So you're part of the 53% that does have tap water. 40%, this is staggering, 40% of the world's population doesn't have access to a toilet. That's huge. And in a country like South Sudan, this figure rises to, hold your seat, 93%. Can you imagine? It's a country of about 11 million people. 93% of them don't have access to a toilet. What do they do? Imagine you women. Imagine what do you do when you don't have access to privacy? It must be a huge, huge problem. So, believe me, you and I are rich beyond compare. In fact, we are part of the super rich in the world. But it's all relative, isn't it? We think of ourselves, well, I'm middling, I've got a bit of money in the bank and I can afford to have a car, so I must be doing all right. But actually, we're super duper rich, aren't we? We really are compared to a lot of the world's population. James left us in chapter 4 with the words, submit yourselves to God. Come near to God and he will come near to you. Lovely words. And James piles in on chapter 5 with this colourful language. He's so passionate about it, about the people who are depending on their riches for their coming to God. He said, how selfish you are, how ignorant you are of the people around you. Because you've hoarded your wealth, it says, your food has rotted, your clothes have become moth-eaten, and your money has rusted and corroded and become tarnished. Of course, it's not wrong or a sin to have wealth, but it's wrong to be selfish with our riches. And that's where it hits inside. If God so blesses us with prosperity and resources, then we must use it generously. It's imperative that we do that. The rich in James chapter 5 here were selfish with their affluence. They mistreated others. They took advantage of others. And James gives this sober warning in fluorescent lights, neon lights, I suppose. And he's saying, you've treated these people badly. What are you doing? He doesn't mince his words. In fact, he says that God's judgment is come upon you. He stands at the door. And he uses words like weeping and howling, misery. It reminds me of the young man who had an encounter with Jesus in Luke chapter 18. Jesus spoke to the rich young ruler. And Jesus knew this rich young ruler's heart. And he said, sell everything you have and give it to the poor. Instead, lay up for yourselves treasure in heaven. And then one of the saddest verses in the Gospels, he went away with a heavy heart because he was very wealthy. He wouldn't be prepared to give up his riches. We're not going to be like that, are we? We're not going to hoard our gold and our valuables. It will never give us security. Our future is in God alone. Our security is in God alone. We must use our resources, even if it's just a £5 note. We must use our resources to glorify God. It would be a sad day if I was being known to be uncaring and heartless towards others. It's completely against the grain for what Christ has done for me. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. He gave everything. He didn't wait till we're all nicely polished up. But as Helen said, he sought us out. Every resource, he sought us out. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. So we want to be big-hearted. We want to be generous. We want to be put others first, kind, helpful. I don't know whether you saw the thing I put in Grapevine. Was it 2 weeks ago about money? I trust that you read that. If you didn't, then go back and read it. And it was just a heartfelt cry to say, well, look, you know, there are things we want to do as a church to bless other people. As a church, we're rich. And out of those riches, we want to be generous. We want to be kind-hearted. We want to be good. And so this is an opportunity for us to do that. I've got a video here, Jay John, just to help us think about those things. How do I get there? Here he is. Have we got sound? Oops, I've gone the wrong way. I'm going backwards, aren't I?
An airport.
Should I just go back to those two words? Okay?
There was a man at an airport and he wanted to buy a bag of very small donuts. And a coffee. So he got inside the small donuts and buy this coffee. And he was looking for somewhere to sit. But all the tables are all taken. But there's one table where there's one man sitting. And he thinks, oh, I'll just go and sit opposite him. So he goes there, he puts his coffee down, he puts his bag down, gets his coat off, puts it on the chair, sits down. Opens his coffee, has a sip, picks up the bag of donut, opens it, takes out the donut, starts eating it, puts the bag down. The man opposite stretches over, picks up the bag of donut, opens it, takes out a donut, starts eating it, puts the bag down, smiles. The other man cannot believe what he has just seen. He cannot believe that the man has just stolen one of his donuts. He's thinking, what is the world coming to? What is the world? But then he thinks, well, maybe, you know, the guy's not quite there, or, you know, he better not say anything in case the guy kind of erupts and is violent. But he gives him one of these, it looks pathetic. He picks up the bag of donuts, he takes out another donut, and he moves it near to his coffee, as far away from the other man. While he's sipping his coffee, the man stretches over, picks up the bag, takes out another donut, starts eating it, puts it on the table, pushes it back, smiles. The other guy can't believe it. He's done it twice. He's stolen two of my donuts. He's amazed. He can't believe it. He's really angry. But he decides not to say anything. Anyway, the man gets up to leave. So the other man thinks it's about time you left your donut thief. He put his coat on, he picked up his bag, and he then picked up the bag of donuts. There's one donut inside. He takes it out, he breaks it in half, he puts half in his mouth, puts half on the bag, he moves the bag, he smiles, he waves, off he goes. The other guy thinks, I'm not touching that donut, you donut thief. You're probably full of infection. Anyway, he looks at his watch. Oh, it's time for me to go. He gets up, he puts his coat on, he then bends down to pick up his bag, and sitting on top of his bag was his bag of donuts.
All right, we'll stop it there, but if you want to see the full one, then just look up J. John Donuts and you'll get the rest of it. But it is so important, isn't it? And we need to be generous with the things that God gives us. So that's the deep end. All right, we are rich. Let's not be selfish. Let's be generous with God, with what God has given us. He owns all the donuts anyway, doesn't he? All right, so the second bit is about being patient, which is where we came at the beginning. Be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. You too be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. Brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, they count as blessed those who have persevered. You have heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. So So here it is, be patient. The former verses were talking about the Lord coming in judgment against the rich. Here, the Lord's coming for his brothers and sisters in expectation, in eager expectation. And you and I are part of that. We're still waiting for the Lord to come. James puts the example of farmers as an illustration of the patience. He plants the seed and waits patiently for the harvest. He reads the seasons and is wise to the current times. We need to be wise to the things that's happening around us. He waits with expectation for the coming reward. I wonder, when we think about the Lord's coming, is there a real expectation in our hearts? Do we say yes? Or is it just something we think about? Is there a real jump in our hearts when we talk about the Lord's coming back? The harvest is out of his control, the farmer's control. He depends utterly on God. He plants the seed. It is God that gives the growth. As time goes on, patience is more important. Patience is more important in our generation than it was in our mum and dad's generation or our granddad's generation and so on. The closer we get to the second coming of the Lord, the more patient we need to be. We're 1 year closer than we were last year. We're 1 month closer than we were back at Christmas. We're 1 day closer than yesterday. He could come back at any second. Isn't that amazing? He could come back in our lifetime. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Hey, would you like to be there? Oh, yes, Lord. But if not, we're still patient. And we'll give it to our children and to our grandchildren. And in their generation, they'll have their expectation. The Lord is at hand. The Lord's coming is exciting no matter what the season is. We need to read the seasons. And yes, there are things that are happening in our world. And we think, yes, it's got to happen now. It's got to happen today, tomorrow, this week, this month. It's got to happen. And it doesn't. But we still have that expectation, which will grow more and more in our hearts. It says in verse 8, stand firm. The AV talks about having our heart established. The literal meaning of that is to turn resolutely in a certain direction. So we're not looking back at the past. We're looking forward to the hope. We're resolutely going forward to Jesus' return. That's why we sing about it. That's why we rejoice about it. That's why we have that excitement in our hearts. Every generation since the ascension of Jesus has lived with that expectation that the Lord's second coming is at hand. And we're exactly the same as those that we read about in the Bible. James says, the Lord's coming is at hand. And we say, the Lord's coming is at hand. We have not lost heart after 2,000 years. We're even more excited. We're even more patient. It's as though from the time Jesus ascended, history came to a cliff edge. We came along, and we stopped at this cliff edge. And we await his return for history to be wrapped up. Ever since then, we've been traveling along the edge of the cliff. At any moment, it will tip over and history will be all wrapped up. And we're right on that edge. We're still on the same edge as when this letter was written by James. We're still on that edge and history is taking us along. James in verse 9 reminds us not to grumble against one another. We're not like that. I thought, oh, well, you know, this bit doesn't apply to us. Let's face it, when we're going through tough times, it's so easy to grumble and moan, isn't it? We're all the same. We're all like that. Well, I hope you are, because otherwise it's just me. Let's say we can be less than loving towards our Christian brothers and sisters. And it's easy to fall into that feeling. I remember Paul said in 2 Corinthians 5:10, remind us, he said, verse 1 of it, Corinthians 2, verse 10, reminds us that we will all stand before the judgment seat of Christ, not to determine our eternal destiny, but to give account of the things that we've said and done, or not said. And so we'll give an account for those things. One day we will stand before Jesus James mentions the example of the Old Testament prophets and to Job. Here the illustration of patience and suffering and endurance and perseverance. He admonishes, he adores them, and he says, they prophesied, they never saw what they'd revealed in their prophecies, but they trusted in God's timing. They didn't waver from it. They still declared it, even though they never saw it. God is full of compassion and mercy. If he hadn't have delayed, if he'd come back 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or whatever, 50 years ago, you would be part of God's kingdom, would you? Just think about it. If God had returned some time in the past, we would have missed out. But God is gracious and merciful, full of compassion. And so he wraps us up into his kingdom as well. And he saved us from a fate worse than death. Okay, so the third thing then is... I'll get mixed up. All right, speak the plain truth, verse 12. It says, above all, my brothers and sisters, do not swear, not by heaven or earth or by anything else. All you need to say is a simple yes or no. Otherwise, you'll be condemned. It's true that we need to be people that always speak the truth. If we lie or bend the truth a little bit, it shows that we're not confident in who we are. We're trying to convince people that we tell the truth. I trust that your language, and mine of course, is fitting for our profession as a Christian. This verse, to me, speaks about the integrity of our words. When we say something, we mean it. When we say we'll do something, we do it. When we say we'll be there, we be there. Of course, life circumstances all get mixed up. You know, there's children and the car breaks down and all sorts of things. But our heart and our determination is always to be full of integrity. So when we say something, we actually mean it. When we say yes, we mean yes. If we say no, we mean no. Right? Let's not be wishy-washy with our words. Sometimes we say yes with our fingers crossed behind our back, so to speak, don't we? But we shouldn't be like that. We should always be honest and truthful in whatever we say. And then the fourth section about our prayer life. Prayer is powerful. Verse 13, is anyone among you in trouble? Let him pray. If anyone is happy, let him sing songs of praise. If anyone among you is ill, let them call the elders of the church and pray over them, to pray over them and anoint them with oil in the name of the Lord. The prayer offered in faith will make the sick person well. The Lord will raise them up. If they have sinned, they'll be forgiven. Therefore, confess your sins to each other and pray for each other so that you may be healed. The prayer of a righteous person is powerful and effective. Elijah was a human being, even as we are. He prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and didn't rain on the land for 3.5 years. And again he prayed, and the heavens gave their rain up, and the earth produced its crops. Prayer is powerful. We know that, don't we? But do we really mean it the way James says it? James describes three kinds of people: the troubled, the happy, and the sick. For the troubled, or another version talks about those who are afflicted, pray. If you're happy, sing songs of praise. And if you're ill, call the elders for them to pray with you, or pray over you, and anoint with your oil. It's interesting that there's a distinction between the afflicted and the ill, because you often put those two things together. You'd think they were the same. I've got a suggestion to think around this, perhaps, in a different way. So why is there a distinction? I think we need to learn that sometimes in our lives we have afflictions rather than illnesses. It would seem when afflictions come our way, they are used by God in his wisdom to correct my thinking, or to teach me something I'm not listening. Teach me something I'm not missing, or I am missing. Verse in Psalm 32 says this: I will instruct you and teach you in the way that you should go. This is God speaking. I will counsel you with my loving eye on you. Do not be like the horse or the mule, which have no understanding, but must be controlled by a bit and bridle, or they will not come to you. First thing to note here in this verse is that God does it all out of a loving heart, right? He doesn't do it out of a mean heart. He doesn't whack us across with a plank across the back of our heads or something like that. He does it out of a loving heart. When you put a bit into a bridle, no, when you put a bit into a horse's mouth or a mule's mouth, when you pull, it hurts the horse. That's why it goes like that, and it turns that way. No, it goes that way. And it hurts them. You're putting a little bit of affliction in their lives as well, and it is turning them. And it says here that we can be like the horse or the mule, which has no understanding, but must be controlled. And so God says, I will instruct you this way, and that way. Right? We need to allow God. Sometimes we're stubborn. Sometimes we're hard-hearted. And sometimes we're blind to the obvious. And we need to discernment about, we need that discernment to know when affliction is God just taking us this way, or God is teaching me something. Right? So affliction can be different to illness. And sometimes we stand against it and we cast the devil out and we do all these sort of things. When really we need to just sit back and say, Lord, what are you trying to say in this? Not every affliction. Sometimes it is the enemy coming against us. That's why we need discernment. But sometimes God uses affliction to turn our lives, to correct us, to teach us something. So that's my idea. James in verse 14 says, to the sick, he says, call the elders of the church to pray over them and anoint them with oil. It's interesting that in Bible times, olive oil was often used as a healing balm. The word that James used for anoint is a word that was generally used for medicinal meaning. So it could be that James is hinting towards that using oil was for medicinal purposes. So I've always said in my life for many, 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 many years now that I believe in prayer and ointment. So yes, I believe in prayer, and I want God to heal me. I want God to be part of my healing. I want God to touch me. But also, I'm not afraid of the ointment bit. I'll stick a bit of ointment on. I'll go to a doctor. I'll have a patch in my eye, or whatever it might be. So I believe in prayer and ointment. And the two, I think, go together. We don't trust 100% in ointment, right? We trust 100% in what God will do. We cannot heal ourselves. Only God can heal us. Right? You can pray and pray and pray. We do our bit, but only God will bring the healing. Sometimes in verse 15, I'm underlining that, sometimes sickness is connected with sin. Be careful, don't fall in the error to say that all sickness is a result of sin. So sometimes it is, and it's our responsibility to know the difference. We need to pray the prayer of faith. We don't have to defend God's reputation. If that person isn't healed, that's God's problem, all right? But we need to pray. We must never stop praying for the sick. Do your bit. I'll do my bit. And God will do his in his timing. It's often a point of timing, isn't it? I have written down here, we should always be willing to pray for others these dangerous prayers. Then leave the rest to God. I read something this week and I wrote it down because I thought that's just what I want to say in a better way. If you want to see God work in your life, praying safe won't cut it. It's time to pray boldly. It's time to pray dangerously. I'm up for that. Are you? Praying is powerful. We can make a difference in this world. All right? Through our prayers. All right. I'll be honest here. It says there are times when healing doesn't seem to come immediately or in our time frame, does it? But we must learn to trust God in those circumstances. If we are faithful to do our bit, then God will be faithful to do his bit. Verse 16 talks about confess your sins one to another. An interesting verse this is, because the word confess means to openly or publicly speak out your confession. That's something that we don't do. but it often confession breaks the power of sin. When you read through revivals of the last, 100, 200 years or whatever, I was going to say in every case, I can't say that, but in lots and lots of cases, revival broke out when someone confessed publicly their sin. Perhaps it was a sin against a neighbour or a sin against the church, and they've stood up and said, I'm really sorry for what I've done. And then revival broke out. I wonder if we want revival to break out here. Perhaps we could have that practice or consider that. So in the King James it says, the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. So James gives two environments for an effective prayer. In other words, answered prayer. One is that it's fervent. The second one, that it's by a righteous man. Fervent doesn't mean long prayers. It doesn't even mean to get emotionally worked up. It simply means to care about the things that God cares about. That's fervent prayer. Effective prayer of a righteous man. We need to be people who stand on Christ's righteousness for what God has done in me. Right? We don't come to God and say, look, Lord, I'm great. Will you do this for me? No, we come and accept the humility that God has done everything for me. So we stand on his righteousness. We are a righteous people. Our personal walk is consistent to what we profess as Christians. Yeah, you may know of a man called John Knox, who was a great Scottish reformer. It was reported that the Mary Queen of Scots trembled when John Knox got to his knees. It was said that she was more afraid of his prayers than she was of the armies of Spain. I wonder if I wonder if Boris Johnson is afraid of Mike Gibson. Probably not. He's probably never heard of me. But wouldn't that be something, wouldn't it, if my prayers made Boris Johnson weak at the knees? What effect your and my prayers could have on society around us if we prayed dangerously? Talking of prayer, little Johnny's mum was going by little Johnny's room one night and he saw him kneeling beside his bedside with his head bowed and his hands folded. Bless him, he's a lovely lad. And praying the alphabet. So his mum went in and said, what are you doing, little Johnny? He said, well, I'm saying my prayers, he says, but I couldn't think of what to say. So I'm just saying all the letters of the alphabet, and then God can put the letters together and make up the right words. That's nice, isn't it? Isn't that nice? Sometimes we don't know what to pray. Maybe we just need to give God the letters and let him fix it all together to make the right words. But let's be fervent. Let's stand on his righteousness, and our prayers will be effective. Our prayers will be powerful. Our prayers will change the world. All right, then the last section is 5, restoring wandering believers. These are the final words of James. Right, so as he's thinking about putting his pen down, these are the last words he wrote. And I just wonder how important they are to us as they were to James. Because the whole of the book of James is about getting us back on the right track. It is restoring our faith, restoring the things that we've let slip in our lives, the things that we've accepted for years in and out, and we've let them just become part of our lives and we've forgot about it. And the whole book of James is about do this, do that. Don't just have faith, but have your works. Get on with it as well. Show the world of what God has done. And so he says in verse 19 and 20, the last two verses, my brothers and sisters, if one of you should wander from the truth and someone should bring back that person, remember this, whoever turns a sinner from the error of their way will save them from death and cover a multitude of sins. James cares about backsliders. Restore the wandering believers. This letter, don't forget, was written about 45, 50 AD. So it was only 15 or 20 years after Jesus' death and resurrection. And already James is talking about backsliders. And I think sometimes people get on a bandwagon, the latest thing. and it doesn't really, it's not really honest from their heart, and they backslide from it. And we've got to be aware of dangers like that, that we just get on the latest thing and then we backslide from it. Let's be faithful in what we do. I find it astonishing that man can be so fickle, but then why should I be? No one wanders from the truth deliberately. It happens very slowly. We need our lives to be planted firm and secure where it is indeed rich in God. We need to be established in the truth. We need to live for Jesus. If these are the last important words of James, and trust that's the Holy Spirit speaking, then it must be on God's heart to restore the wanderer, the backslider. I guess everyone knows someone here who's backslidden, who's not really walking the Christian faith life. What would happen if every one of us prayed for one person? All right, I don't know how many is here. Say 60 of us here. Next week, there could be 120 of us here. That's not difficult to believe, is it? We've just got to pray for one backslider. Whether you know them, you know, in Petersfield, or whether it's someone in your distant past. And then you meet them in the street. And you say, I've been praying for you this week. And they say, well, yeah. I just pray that God would come back in your life and do something wonderful. And he says, all right, I'll come to church on Sunday with you then. That'll be good, wouldn't it? Just pray for one backslider. Put that on your list. I don't know how long your list is. Mine's getting a bit longer than this. But put it on your list. One backslider. Ask God, well, who can I pray for? Who can I restore? I think there was a prophecy some years back about this, about praying as a church for those that have left. Surely if it's on God's heart, it ought to be on ours. I thought back and I thought, I can't remember the last time I prayed for a backslider. All right. It's not recent. It's certainly years and years and years ago. So it's going to go on my list. All right. Let's commit to put on each of our lists. So these are just some of the final verses of James, some of the key verses that we've looked at over these months. Consider it pure joy when you face various trials. Remember that? That seemed a long time ago. Consider it pure joy when you face various trials. If any of you lack wisdom, ask God who gives generously. Here's God. He's a generous God. All right? You might end up with 9 donuts, but God's so generous, and you'll end up having enough to do. Submit yourselves to God, resist the devil, and he'll flee from you. When you ask, you don't receive because you ask with wrong motives. Sometimes our motives are selfish, aren't they? And we need to seek God to know that we're doing things for his glory and his thing. Come near to God, and he'll come near to you. What a wonderful promise that is, isn't it? We should have that slammed on our fridges, every one of us. Come near to God, and he'll come near to you. Wow. Got something to do, nothing to do this week. Meditate on that verse. Come near to God, and he'll come near to you. John was saying he's only that far away. No, he's not that far away. All right. If anybody is sick, let him call the elders of the church, pray over them, anoint them with oil in the name of the Lord. These are wonderful verses. And James is called the Proverbs of the New Testament. You can almost pick out any verse. And it's absolutely wonderful. And then the last verse that I've always been a key verse right throughout. Do not merely listen to the word, so deceive yourself. Do what it says. All right? So I think that's it, isn't it? That sums up everything that we've been talking about. Whatever you do, do it. Don't just pray about it, do it. Put your faith into action. So what have you learned this morning? Be generous and kind, be patient, but expect the Lord's return any second now. All right? Surely it's seconds. Surely we're down to seconds. We're not down to weeks and months. We're down to seconds. Always use truthful words. Pray fervently and pray for the backslider. You've all got a little leaflet on you. I've got some more of these. All right, James, you can take away and just use it for your remembrance of those things. Thank you very much. I trust you've enjoyed James as much as I have. We've dipped into some of the subjects and learned a lot. So what should we do next? Answers in a postcard. I'm up for ideas. up for chance. Chance is not Isaiah, because it's 60-odd chapters. It'll take us 20 years to do it. Bless you. Thank you.